Welcome to Watchmen on the Wall, a daily outreach of Southwest Radio Ministries and SWRC.com. God is still on the throne, and prayer changes things. Today, Micah Van Hus and author Dan Biddle continue their conversation about the Nephilim. Friends, we're just 10 days away from our Mysteries of the Bible Verse Conference, Friday and Saturday, June 13th and 14th in Carmel, Indiana. Uncover the hidden truths of Scripture and explore the mysteries your Sunday school teacher never mentioned. Who were the giants in the Bible? Are UFOs real? Do secret societies have biblical origins? And are we truly alone in the universe? Join us for an eye-opening journey into the unexplained, featuring top experts who bridge faith, prophecy, and history. Speakers include Derek and Sharon Gilbert, Carl Gallups, Mac Dominic, Michael Hoggard, and Micah Van Hus. Register today when you visit the events page of our website, swrc.com, or you can register by calling 1-800-652-1144. VIP packages are available, and children 12 and under are free. Mysteries of the Bible Verse, June 13th and 14th in Carmel, Indiana. Now, here's today's host, Micah Van Hus.
Welcome to the program, folks. Here at Marginal Mysteries, we like to study God's awesome creation. We're not afraid to ask questions, pretty much any question, because we do so from a solid biblical foundation. And today we're joined again by Dr. Dan Biddle. His latest book is The Nephilim. He works with Genesis Apologetics, and we've been talking about giants in the Americas. And we're picking up again today, talking about the cover-up of the giant skeletons and some of the Native American stories about the giants in North America. Dan, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Biddle, if you don't mind, tell us some of these fascinating Native American stories about the giants here in America that you write about in your book.
Yeah, certainly. Some of the ones that I found more interesting are things like the Iroquois legend about what they call the stone giants. And they would say that these giants who were cannibals and also into dark magic practices would intentionally go rub themselves in sand, do a full body sand scrub in order to develop calluses over their body or thicker skin so that the Indians' arrows would not penetrate when they were being attacked. And they actually have drawn pictures in the 1800s.
Maybe they had heard about David and Goliath.
Yeah, maybe they had heard about it. They've got these pictures of Native Americans shooting arrows into the faces and the eyes of the giants.
I'll interrupt right there. You know, the story of the giant of Kandahar, they were told to shoot for the face.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard about that story, and that's one of the great mysteries. Maybe one of these days the truth will come all the way out, but there's a lot of people that allegedly say that went down as they report it.
I'm sorry, I interrupted with that shooting in the face. No, you were okay. Saying they would shoot at the face.
Another one is about an interesting legend about a Native American mom who had a kid, and the kid was about the same height as her when he was a young teenager, then grew up to be, you know, twice the size of a normal man, and was so big that he would kill deer and put them into his belt, you know, loop to hold them as he's walking around. And then he had a fort that was attacked, and the writer of this account actually went to this giant's fort. He would shoot big arrows that all these guys were scared of and everything. There are all kinds of documented stories about the Native Americans. The Native Americans with giants, it really comes in two buckets, and sometimes they're connected and sometimes they're not. One would be their mythical motif of giants and how they were used to teach and convey lessons and stories that were children's bedtime stories, and they would admit it. They're just mythical colored things. But on the other hand, there's a ton of Native American evidence. In fact, 20 different tribes that we've documented are like, no, these creatures were real. They were into sick, dark magic stuff. They were cannibals. Sometimes they enslaved our people, and we warred against them. And some of the Native American tribes actually report forming alliances with other tribes to go against these giants. And other instances where some of the people who lived with, like the Sioux and other Native American tribes, would say, Yeah, there were these giants who were here before us. They are the ones who are responsible for building the mounds and the earthworks. And we didn't like them. And they were 10 feet tall. And we finally annihilated these guys, or the Great Spirit took care of them. We're not just talking about a few different one-off stories from the Native Americans. And we're also not talking about stories that were only carried down by word of mouth. We're talking about documented stories that are recorded in the first pages of the first books ever written by Native Americans on North America, and European historians who came over here and interviewed the Native Americans about this. And the strange part about this is the Native Americans, with these accounts, they didn't sensationalize it. They're like, oh yeah, it happened. It's part of our history. Big deal. Everybody knows about the giants. The Europeans are like, what? What are you talking about, these giants? But the Native Americans like, well, of course, you guys don't know about the giants? Of course, they're part of our history. They built these mounds and these structures. It's very interesting how their accounts and their orientation about the giants is much different than the Europeans who came here.
And you've just now started to talk about the earth mounds and the maybe even hinted at the advanced technology. And that's something, of course, we like to talk about is the advanced technology when we get into building the pyramids and the different structures, the ancient megaliths. And so let's talk about that a little bit. And in your book, you start to talk about those and the knowledge of the stars, et cetera. And that brings us back into the knowledge of the watchers, which the Bible doesn't specifically get into. It mentions the knowledge of the sons of Lamech in Genesis chapter 4. But you have mentioned in one of your videos that I watched, I haven't heard anybody else talk about this, but you have mentioned it, and I was very pleased to see it. Revelation chapter 21, verse 17, when John is seeing his vision of heaven, the man is using the cubit, and you actually linked that to the angels, which, of course, Revelation 21, 17 says. And so I was very happy to see you say that. So talk to us a little bit about the technology involved, like the serpent mound, the most popular in Ohio. We didn't even know it was in the shape of a serpent swallowing an egg until later in years when we could actually get above and see. The ancient Indians, they actually built it. So talk to us a little bit about this technology involved.
Yeah, if you want to make the Nephilim connection, it's three steps, and it's very clear, very straightforward. Number one, God has an express prohibition against celestial worship. In fact, he says, if you do it, I'm going to turn my back against you. He said, do not worship the sun, moon, and stars. Very specific thing that God, Yahweh, the maker of heaven and earth, said, don't you do this. So that's one. The next step is look at North America and some of these ancient earthworks of what the people that are called the Hopewell or the Adena or some of the Fort Ancient people. Those are European assigned names to those bracketed time intervals of the people who lived in these big mounds and earthworks, and look at the celestial orientation that's going on and where did that knowledge and information come from. It is incredible. In Ohio alone, there are 498 earthworks, and several of them have megatons worth of earth and rock that are designed to build structures and plazas and complexes that have lunar orientations to an 18.6-year lunar cycle. Those structures were built with millions of hours of labor and over hundreds of years probably with lots of people, and they were built intentionally to worship the sun, moon, and stars, an express prohibition by God. And then the third thing that is interesting just to color in is what's going on with the obsession with serpents, with a lot of these Native Americans. Now listen, I love the Native American people and the community, and I'm honoring those people by representing the history that they conveyed to us about some of the earlier mound builder cultures. So I'm not in any way, shape, or form being defaming or insensitive towards Native Americans. I'm just saying, if you look at the history of the people who were here, with whatever label you want to put on them, Hopewell, Adena, Fort Ancient, or some other word, just the mound builders, those people groups who the Native Americans said were the Native Americans that we knew in the 1600s and 1700s would say, oh yeah, that was built by the tall race of people that were here before us. So it's even further disassociated. For some reason, they were really into the snake stuff. They were hammering out copper snakes and serpents. And don't even get us started on the serpent mound in Ohio. I mean, why on earth would you build a quarter mile long snake that's eating an egg with a human sacrifice altar in the middle of the egg and the open mouth of the snake. And then why would you cover all that stuff up? I mean, there was an altar there and it's gone now. We've got pictures of it that are 100 years old. It's obviously a sacrificial altar. And they found implement and burned stuff around the area. It's kind of like the truth is out about that. But a lot of these people groups back then, by whatever label you want to call them, they were really into the whole snake stuff. Why wasn't it a frog or some other thing? But why would you glorify a serpent? And then why would you have the serpent in its mouth lined up with solstices or equinoxes or many of these other different celestial events that were happening? When you put those three things together, it's very obvious that there was a giant phenomenon going on here, something that required advanced knowledge. We're talking about pi, square root, and advanced geometry to build these structures. How different is that than the Native Americans that we came to know who were living in wigwams and teepees and being hunter-gatherers and using the technology that they were using in those days? How was it that those cultures are so different? Still, everybody's smart. Everybody's working with their environment. I mean, you take your average European and drop him here in the middle of Ohio in the wilderness in the 1600s, and he'd be dead in a week. Mm. Yeah, the Native Americans were super skilled at doing what they were doing, but their cultures were different from the 1600s and the 1700s than they were from thousands of years before. And then those Native Americans also disassociated themselves in many instances with the mound builders.
And you see that tiered technology in the architecture all over the world, from Egypt to Central America. You'll see a much finer building techniques, and then on top of it, as if centuries afterwards, civilizations came, took the things that were built before and built much cruder buildings on top of what was before. You can see that in the pictures of the building steps. Now, when we're talking about the serpents, you've also got the Mexican or Central American god Quetzalcoatl. They've been worshiping these serpents. You said scripture says not to worship the stars. And of course, stars represent angels in many instances. Yeah. And so here they are worshiping. We got the Nakash, the serpent in the garden, type of angel. And so it's almost as if these gods of old were actually real beings. It all seems to fit together like a puzzle.
The way that I frame that when I talk is I said, look, the worship systems and rituals and rites and sacrifices, if you look at Cahokia, there are places in America where we found 270 sacrificed women of the same age bracket. So there was human sacrifice going on at many of these places. These people didn't wander off into the forest and think, what I'm going to worship, I don't know, a snail god or the pink spaghetti monster god or whatever. They were inspired by the dark forces, Ephesians 6, the rulers, the principalities, and the authority. They were inspired to defy and rebel against Yahweh, the God who says, don't you dare worship the sun, moon, and stars, or all this serpent stuff. Their worship practices were very much correlated with the dark side of the Old Testament, the things expressly forbidden by God.
Here's an important question that a lot of folks have been asking. How do you think that the giants ended up in North America?
You can look at giant researchers like L.A. Marzulli and some others that have some very interesting theories about how they went south through Israel and then kind of island hopped and then eventually got on seafaring ships and made it over to the East Coast. I think all that stuff's very, very possible. In fact, there's some interesting things in the chemistry of copper that they've correlated between the copper found and used by the Adena people, some of the mound builders, that was quarried out of Michigan or found in Michigan, uncovered in Michigan, and some of the copper that they found all the way over in Europe. So there is some evidence of some trade going on hundreds of years ago and some travel between continents like that was going on. But simply put, angels are interdimensional beings, so they didn't necessarily have to travel over here. They could have looked upon women and lusted over them, Native Americans over here, and had kids by them with their offspring being the Nephilim in the same way that they did in the Genesis 6 phenomenon and the Numbers 13 phenomenon and Deuteronomy and all the other patches that talk about the giants, like the sons of Anak and the Anakim and the Raphaim, who were Nephilim tribes.
And I think that's absolutely right. And we also don't have to look at it as a, like you said, a local phenomenon. They did it worldwide. But also, I think that a lot of the giants, just like they were wiped out of the promised land, I think in the European countries, the giants were hunted out and they thrived over here in the Americas because they weren't hunted out like they were in Europe and the Middle East. So I think that also had a bit to do with it, but definitely a fascinating topic. So
yes.
What do you want folks to take away from this book?
Two things. It's very simple. I want people to understand that the Bible is credible history, and so it's valid enough for people to rest their faith tentacles in it. A lot of people these days and that the newer generations are saying, well, I'm a New Testament Christian. I love Jesus. But I'm like, wait a second. You can't even explain the gospel without a real garden and real sin. So without a historical narrative of Genesis, the gospel is undermined. And so a real gospel requires a real garden with real people in real history with real sin and real consequences. And so people should need to open their Bibles and understand it's got a true narrative of history. That's the first thing, because it's a faith rooting issue. People get saved all the time without a full understanding of Genesis. That typically comes later for most people who are drowned in propaganda of the world. But the second thing is, I want people to have a healthy skepticism when they go in places like natural history museums and they hit the whole millions of years of evolution displays to think, you know what? I'm not going to believe in that. I choose to believe in the narrative of God's history over what's being pitched to me in public schools, natural history museums, TV, movies, the whole bit. It would be those two things, to root people in faith and develop a grounded skepticism of the narrative of the world.
So what's next for you and for Genesis Apologetics? You guys are putting out some great movies, great works. So is there anything in the works right now? Well, I know there is. So what's in the works?
Yeah,
tell us
sure.
about.
We are a network of volunteers and paid contractors, and so we're able to scale up and down based upon project loads. Right now, as we speak, in fact, we've got a whole team of videographers and DPs and directors and the whole bit over in Arizona with a ton of actors on our next movie. It's going to be called Out of Babel, and it will feature the giant phenomenon. And we're going to be talking about dinosaurs and dragons that lived after the flood. It's going to be a very interesting movie because we're going to show the history and the dialogue that could have happened between the Native American historians in 1620 when the pilgrims arrived there at that time. And they exchange and compare histories about dragons, the giants, biblical history about the flood, Babel, creation, all that, because there are some undeniable Native American legends and histories that have a very strong overlap with Scripture. So that's what's next. You can just go to outofbabel.com to learn about that movie. It should come out in about a year's time. And then we continue to speak at conferences and churches and put out a lot of video content on social media platforms.
So I was just looking through my notes. We've got a few minutes left. I was just looking through my notes to see what questions I wanted to ask, but you just mentioned the dinosaurs after the flood. Over my shoulder here, this is my left shoulder, second book, The Earth As It Was, we talk about dinosaurs, and we talk about dinosaurs after the flood and the different stories. Are you able to talk a few minutes about some of the dinosaurs after the flood? You mentioned some of the stories of dinosaurs the Native Americans had talked about. So what's maybe a fascinating story about dinosaurs after the flood that some of the ancients tell about?
Yeah, there's lots of them. We're coming out with a book and a movie on dragons. It's just simply called Dragons Were Dinosaurs. The short biblical perspective on the dragon phenomenon is that birds and fish were created on day 5 spontaneously by God out of the dust, out of nothing, breathed into existence, and then mammals and man on day 6. Then God told Adam to name everything, taking dominion over them, and then be stewards over the earth and go be fruitful and multiply. Then the fall came, sin, death, the curse, suffering, bloodshed, carnivorism, all that stuff happened. The animals turned against themselves because Genesis 1 is very clear. They started out as vegetarian, but after the fall, everything turned. Then the flood happens with a biblical narrative about 1,656 years after creation. And then between 80 and 100 different dinosaur varieties at the family level, not the species, about 1,000 species that have been identified of dinosauria kinds, but only about 100 at the family level, they board the ark as juveniles. They get off the ark, and most of them probably went through extinction really quickly. They're hunted by man. Their food sources are different. Their food sources are scarce. and you don't want big scary creatures hanging around your campfire at night. But if you look through history, it's not some, it's not half, it's most major cultures around the world have dragon history. And here's the scary part, but prove me wrong, you can't. This is absolutely truth as far back as their histories go. Most cultures, as far back as their histories are written, have narrations about dragon-like creatures that when they're painted or carved or talked about or described, all look like dinosaurs that we have in the fossil record that we know existed before the flood. So they get off, they move to extinction after the flood, but two different species, or let's say kinds of dinosaurs, typically show up all the way into the medieval era. So let's say 1500s or 1600s until these stories pretty much stop at that point. And it's the theropod varieties and thunderbirds, or what are called, you know, pterosaurs. Many different people groups, like if you look at the Native Americans, this thunderbird thing was amazing. It's everywhere. Multiple tribes had the thunderbird idea in their histories, but they had it very clearly two ways. They'll talk about thunderbird mythology a lot, about the metaphor of the thunderbirds, or they'll come out when the thunder happens, or they make the thunder. There's all kinds of mythologized things about that. But there's also several accounts of these Native Americans say, oh yeah, we killed one and shot it down. Here's how long it was. Here's what it looked like. We found its footprints. It used to fly down and swoop and pick our people up and pick up deer by the river. I mean, woo, there's lots of real pterosaur-like accounts from the Native Americans. We're going to be featuring one of those in our movie about the Piassa bird and really going into that more deeply. And the second one we're going to be covering in our movie is a creature called a diadon, which is a large wild boar. And the fossil record, the secular idea of these creatures is that they went extinct just a few million years ago. But the fossil records show that these creatures were the size of bison, about 6 feet at the shoulder, but they were wild boar on their morphology with big tusks and everything. And there's not one, not two, but about a half a dozen Native American tribes that all say, we had a creature like this. We called it the naked bear or the hairless bear or the king of bears. And they recorded multiple stories about killing these creatures or being terrified of them because they would ambush women and children. Mm-hmm. And they have multiple stories about hunting these things down and killing them. In fact, the last one they said was killed along the Hudson River and buried in the year 1790, all for a creature that they say was extinct millions of years ago, but not according to the Native American history. And I'm talking about histories that was recorded by Jesuits and European archaeologists and the Native American legends themselves. I mean, even the Iroquois to this day have got a song that they sing, a chant, hey, don't be too loud, don't cry, or the naked bear will come eat you. So again, not a myth. They're like, no, we were terrified of this thing. And they knew what bears were. They knew what panthers were. They knew what wild pigs were like. They're like, no, there's bears and then there's a naked bear. So we're going to feature that in our movie too. We've hired some excellent visual effects artist, Ralph Strand with Sevenfold Films, is going to be responsible for rigging and portraying the Thunderbird pterosaur scene as well as the naked bear wild boar scene. He's going to do a terrific job, and we're super excited to bring these to the big screen.
Well, I'm excited to see that. So your background. Are you familiar with Roman historian Aeneas Aurelius's account of Alexander the Great's encounter with a dragon, 100-foot-tall dragon?
It's incredible, and they hung the skin in the Roman Senate.
This is recorded history.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And it's not just that. I mean, it's dozens and dozens of accounts like this. And I think personally, a lot of them are completely fabricated. A lot of them are exaggerated, but a lot of them, you read them and you're like, what on earth? And it sounds like they're in alignment with very real creatures.
You know, where did they go? Reptiles are indeterminate. That means they grow based on their environment. And after the flood, conditions are very different than they were before the flood. And so much like Noah's age and his son's age, as mankind goes from 900 years down to 120 years over the generations, I think reptiles' size went down and down and down. Fascinating stuff, and I very much look forward to seeing your Out of Babel work. Dr. Biddle, it's been fascinating talking with you. Folks, if you've enjoyed listening to Dr. Biddle talk about his latest book, The Nephilim. We're selling it here at Southwest Radio Ministries. You can get your copy at swrc.com. You can call 800-652-1144, or you can visit our website, marginalmysteries.com. Dr. Biddle, how can folks get a hold of you and what you folks do over there at Genesis Apologetics?
Yeah, please email me at dan@genesisapologetics.com, and that's the website, just genesisapologetics.com, where you can learn about giants specifically by going to biblegiants.com.
Be sure to leave a like, share, and subscribe, and we'll see you next time. Dr. Biddle, it was a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Today in our Resource Center, we're featuring Dan Biddle's book, The Nephilim. Inside the pages of The Nephilim, explore shocking evidence that giants of biblical proportions once roamed North America. Were giants merely myth, or did they walk among us? Was Goliath just a lone warrior, or did entire tribes of giants exist, challenging God's people in battle? Find out in The Nephilim. Drawing from a database of 885 historical reports, detailing over 3,000 giant skeletons, The Nephilim explores the biblical and historical accounts of giants and their origins, Native American legends describing giant adversaries, the Smithsonian cover-up theory, mysterious megalithic structures, weapons, and tools, and the eerie six-finger phenomenon and double-row teeth anomalies. Could these ancient giants be the Nephilim of the Bible? Were they wiped out, or is there more to the story? Find out in The Nephilim by Dan Biddle. Order your copy of The Nephilim today when you call 1-800-652-1144. That's 1-800-652-1144. You can also order on our website, swrc.com. Friends, we're so glad you're here today. If you're a new listener to Watchmen on the Wall, make sure you request your new listener pack. Inside, you'll find the latest issue of our Prophetic Observer newsletter and a special gift. Request your free new listener pack when you call 1-800-652-1144. That's 1-800-652-1144. Friends, if you have a prayer need, would you let us pray for you? We consider it an honor to pray with you. Prayer requests come in from all over the country through the mail, on the phone, and now through a special email address, prayer@swrc.com. That's prayer@swrc.com. Or you can always just give us a call, 1-800-652-1144. Tomorrow, we find out what's next on God's Calendar with Dr. Rob Lindstedt. Watchmen on the Wall is a production of Southwest Radio Ministries and is supported by faithful listeners like you. To learn more, visit our website, swrc.com. That's swrc.com.